Hi, this is Barry Liss at INFORMS, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science of Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling are affecting people like you and organizations like your own. In today's segment, we speak with Professor Lawrence Wine, an expert in homeland security, particularly bioterror and related border issues. Professor Wine is with the Graduate School of Business at Stanford University. Professor Wine, welcome to the Science of Better.
Thank you, Barry.
In the Morse lecture that you delivered in 2008, you described several potential terrorist attack scenarios. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what they are, or should I say what kind of attack agents that they involve?
Yeah, my work since 9/11 has focused on the catastrophic possibilities, ways that terrorists could kill, say, 100,000 people on U.S. soil, and I know of five of these. One is a nuclear weapon, one is an attack on a chemical plant or certain types of chemical plants. The other three are biological agents, smallpox, anthrax, and botulinum toxin.
And in your talk, in your paper, you went into detail on anthrax, on the botulinum toxin in terms of our food supply, also pandemic influenza, which became especially relevant in 2009. And you also talked about border issues, especially a federal program called the U.S. Visit. Let's examine your work modeling these scenarios and your proposed responses, beginning with anthrax. What's unique about the danger of an anthrax attack, and what were your proposals?
What's unique about it is that it's highly durable among all biological and chemical agents. It could literally stay viable for decades on end. It also, if weaponized properly, can be dispersed quite widely, and it almost becomes like a gas, and so it can get inside and travel broad areas. And the third one is that the inhalational form of anthrax is highly deadly. So if you don't get any medical countermeasures, then probably 90 to 95% of the people who get infected would die. So we developed a mathematical, kind of a spatial and temporal model that looked at the spores being released in New York City from the top of a 30-story building and getting distributed out, and looking at various countermeasures. We found that the main leverage point was rapid antibiotic distribution. So antibiotics can be used as a prophylactic, that is, to prevent disease if you have not yet developed symptoms. And we found that in our base case, 123,000 people died from 2.2 pounds of anthrax spores released in New York City, and that about 10,000 people died for every day that it took to distribute the antibiotics. So after writing the main paper that was in Proceedings National Academy of Sciences, Ed Kaplan and I wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post where we proposed that we use postal workers to distribute antibiotics. The approach before this was to use points of dispensing, pods as they're called, which would be like going to your area high school and picking up the antibiotics, much as the same way as we vote.
It's a little interesting, the idea that postal workers become the hero in this scenario.
They do. After being the victim in 2001, they would now be the hero. And indeed, after we wrote this op-ed, people in the government took this idea and ran with it, and there have been three tests done in Boston, St. Louis, and Philadelphia. There's Washington, D.C. has already agreed on a voluntary basis to do this. Voluntary meaning they won't force the postal workers to do this. But indeed, all of these exercises went very well, and they found that the postal workers really do want to be the heroes and are very eager, for the most part, to partake in this.
You talk about the strategic national stockpile and improvements that must take place. What is a strategic national stockpile, and what needs to be done, or what did you recommend that may have been accepted?
So the Strategic National Stockpile holds many different medical countermeasures for a variety of different biological, chemical, and nuclear attacks. They're in roughly a dozen different secret locations throughout the country, and the idea of if an attack occurs in a particular place, you would immediately release these countermeasures from the closest stockpile to the particular city that got hit, and probably fly them or possibly drive them, but in most cases probably fly them to the nearest airport at that city and then distribute them locally. And we found, I also did a study for the White House looking at different ways to distribute antibiotics locally, and looked at the postal option in particular and pods. But we found that if you switch from pods to the postal option, the bottleneck of the whole process switches from the local distribution to actually the Strategic National Stockpile. So at the time, the Strategic National Stockpile had 650,000 antibiotics for anthrax that were broken down in a form that could rapidly be sent to the closest city, say in about 8 or 10 hours. And we proposed that the amount that has to be put into this flexible form would be about 10 million. And so this would...
So you were recommending a very large increase.
Right, to make the Strategic National Stockpile much more agile. And from what we understand, this is in the process of being done or has been done.
So it sounds like your recommendations are being taken very seriously.
Yes, yes.
And turning to another topic, I remember feeling a kind of visceral dread when I read an op-ed piece that you wrote about the danger to our milk supply of contamination by botulinum toxin. Why is the danger of a terror attack on our milk supply such a high-level threat?
So botulinum toxin is the deadliest poison, or deadliest substance, but it is a poison, known to mankind. And so the infectious dose, the dose that would be required to infect you is roughly a millionth of a gram, so an absolutely tiny amount. And when you combine that deadliness with essentially the operations of the dairy supply chain, so the large-scale storage and production and rapid distribution and consumption of milk, which we consume at the rate of 7 billion gallons per year, you have the potential for a nightmare scenario.
And along the lines of this discussion, you and others were accused of providing ideas to terrorists when you discussed this openly. How did you respond?
Well, we had written a paper. It hadn't been published yet, but I was invited to Washington to present to a number of people in the government on this. And then, the paper was due to come out for publication. And I had also written an op-ed that was going to come out in the New York Times. So the government looked at this paper and claimed that it was a roadmap for terrorists, and they asked the journal, which was the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, not to publish the paper. So there really wasn't much, I could do. They basically put they told me not to talk to the media, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. So for about a month, I could do nothing, and the government was claiming this, and then reviewers went back through the paper, including the president of the National Academy of Sciences, and in the end, the editor of the journal and the president of the National Academy of Sciences disagreed with the government, went ahead and published the paper. There's an editorial from Bruce Alberts, who at that time was the president of the National Academy of Sciences, that came out with my paper, with our paper, and said that not only was it not a roadmap for terrorists, but it helped make the nation safer.
And have you received any feedback since that time?
Well, what came out in the editorial was that the government realized this was a very scary scenario, and they had run tests to see if you could intensify the heat pasteurization process for milk. And indeed, this was one of the three recommendations we had in our paper. And in the end, the government, working with the dairy industry, to their great credit, have intensified the heat pasteurization process for milk so that in the event of a botulinum attack, it would inactivate, you know, much of the toxin.
And so, what were your other two recommendations?
One of them was simply to put locks on the tanks at the farm and the tank trucks that carry the milk, because in our view, if a dairy supply chain in the hands of terrorists could be as dangerous as a nuclear plant, then we need laws, not just voluntary guidelines, to stop this from happening. And the second one was, the last one was a test to come up with an in-process test, because there's a 45-minute window between when a tank truck arrives at a dairy processing facility and when the milk is released into the silo. And if they could develop a test for botulinum toxin within that 45-minute window, then this also could take the scenario off the table.
And
indeed, I found out that there was an existing test that only took 15 minutes, and that's why the main reason I wrote the op-ed in the New York Times. But as far as I know, the government thinks the intensified pasteurization process is enough to make us safe, and that we do not need a test for botulinum toxin in the dairy supply chain.
So, I mean, what I'm hearing is that the Department of Homeland Security and other departments are quite serious, that they're understanding your recommendations and are treating them with the gravity that they deserve.
Yes.
Turning to an issue that's often in the news and in a controversial way, the U.S. border, particularly the border with Mexico. Why is the study of American borders so important to your work?
Well, each of these five catastrophic attacks that I mentioned right at the beginning of our conversation would require at least one terrorist, probably an entire cell of terrorists, to be in the United States to pull off this attack. The only possible exception is to remotely detonate a nuclear weapon, say, at a port. So in addition to looking at these catastrophic threats, I'm also looking at borders of how to keep nuclear weapons and how to keep terrorists out of the country.
And the Boston Globe recently cited a paper you co-authored about the U.S. border with Mexico and the threat of terrorism. It said that the danger of a terrorist successfully crossing the border is an alarming 93%. Why is it so high?
Well, it's a multi-step process to get in. For us to keep a terrorist out of the country, first we would have to apprehend them at the border, so we'd have to kind of catch them. Then we would have to hold them, detain them for long enough so that we could set up the paperwork and everything to send them back to their home country. And this is, if you know, mostly for the most part, if they're not from Mexico. In Mexico, you can just send them across the border. For people who are not Mexican, you're not supposed to just send them back into Mexico. And so what they do is detain them in places called detention and removal operations. So these are detention beds that are, you know, sometimes they rent out county jails, and they also have, especially along the southern border, southwest border, they have large detention facilities, especially for this. And, you know, at least as of several years ago, the bottleneck was really that these detention beds were full, so they would catch people at the border, and they would, by law, you kind of have to hold the people who are being violent or dangerous, or, you know, you think they're drug dealers or something like that. But for the vast majority of them, of course, almost everyone coming across the border is really just coming over to work and get a better life. Anyways, to detain the other people, you need empty bed space, and for most of them, they didn't have empty bed space, so they would simply release them on the streets of the United States and then tell them to go to a courthouse on a particular date at a particular time and give them a slip of paper. And of course, most of the great majority of those people never just fell into the woodwork and never showed up at the courts.
You've made some recommendations about biometrics in this connection, particularly fingerprinting, as a way to screen potential terrorists. Exactly what do you recommend, and how is the federal government, how's their scorecard to date?
Right. So, I mean, terrorists could come into the country in two ways. One is at the ports of entry, say at the airports, and the other way is sneaking across the border, say the U.S.-Mexico border. So in terms of them coming into the ports of entry, we have the U.S. visit program. And originally, after 9/11, what this did was take two fingerprints from the index fingerprints from each person coming in, and they'd compare it to a watch list of about 6 million people who were suspected terrorists and known criminals. And we did a detailed probabilistic analysis of this fingerprint matching and found that there's a certain fraction of people who have poor image quality, about 5% of the U.S. population and about 10% of the people on the terror watch list. And for these people, it's very difficult to match their fingerprints, so that even though overall the average detection probability is around 95%, for the people with the worst image quality, it's more like 50%. And so terrorist organizations could choose people that have the worst quality fingerprint image to try to sneak into the country at the ports of entry, because all things considered, they would prefer to come in above ground and in a legal way. And we analyze what would happen if you use 10 fingers rather than two fingers, and the basic punchline was that even for the people with the worst image quality, there is enough information in 10 fingerprints to make a good match, even though there's not enough information in two fingerprints. So with 10 fingerprints, you could get up to about 95-96% detection probability for everybody. And as a result, I testified before the several subcommittees of the House of Representatives Homeland Security Committee, and then soon thereafter, the ranking member of that committee wrote a letter to then Homeland Security Secretary Ridge, suggesting, based on the Stanford study, to change the fingerprint system from a two-finger system to a 10-finger system. And then about 9 months later, the new Homeland Security Secretary, Chertoff, announced the switch from two to 10 fingers. So now if you come in to the United States airports, you now give over 10 fingers rather than two fingers.
Taking a step back, broadly looking at Homeland Security in the U.S. today, how do you think we're doing in terms of your areas of expertise?
Yeah, to summarize on, so my take on this is, and different people have different takes, but mine is that we should look at these weapons of mass destruction and try to take these catastrophic scenarios off the table. And if we could take everything that could kill 100,000 people or more off the table, so that all the attacks are, you know, on several orders of magnitude lower than I think the Department of Homeland Security would be largely successful. On that end, I would say for smallpox, and that's something Ed Kaplan and I also have worked on together. We have a stockpiled vaccine for everyone in the United States, and would do aggressive mass vaccination if an attack occurred. So I think there we're in good shape. On anthrax, if we can get the antibiotic, if we can use postal workers to get antibiotics out quickly, I think we'll be in reasonably good shape. I think the food security thing, the botulinum toxin, although the milk may be safe, I don't think anyone really knows whether that's the tip of the iceberg or whether there's other food agents that botulinum toxin or some other biological or chemical agent could cause an immense number of deaths. And I think further work has to be done on that. And my co-author Yifan Liu and I have a paper in the Journal of Food Science where we, in 2008, where we come up with a mathematical expression for the number of casualties from any biological or chemical agent in any food supply chain in terms of the characteristics of both the agent and the supply chain. And we gave this to the government. We hope they would use this to try to identify other possibly catastrophic threats. The nuclear one is a tough one. You know, we should be doing more to secure the loose nuclear material. Certainly, the Obama administration appears to be starting a new strategy towards non-proliferation, and so, but there's still a long way to go there. I'd say of the five, the one we've made the least progress on is the chemical plant attack, and indeed that's the easiest of the bunch. You don't need to make any anthrax or get some smallpox or make botulinum toxin or a nuclear weapon. You simply take a small airplane or even a large truck and smash it into an oil refinery. And under the Bush administration, the government really just acquiesced to special interest groups in the chemical industry, and we really haven't made the nation safer on this. And I know President Obama, talked some about this on the campaign trail, and I'm hoping that's one of the first things the new administration does in terms of homeland security.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Professor Lawrence Wine of the Graduate School of Business at Stanford University about his work in homeland security. Professor, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Barry. Nice talking to you.
And thank you for listening to this Science of Better podcast by INFORMS, the Institute for Operations Research and Management Sciences. For more information about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep crunching those numbers.